This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode 13, was recorded on July 31st, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by petroleum geologist Art Berman, author and consultant Anas Alhaji, and professional crude oil trader Tracy Shuchart. Our topics this week will include the EIA data, what's going on with the macro backdrop, and a host of other topics. But first, let's dive right into the EIA data. Crude oil drawing down an utterly massive 8.5 million barrels. Big question mark, though, where did that go? Because, as we'll discuss in just a moment, didn't come out of the usual suspect places. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 1.5 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 1.8 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 894,000 barrels. So, drawdowns across the board. Tape action was a quick pop-up, but not much follow-through, and by the end of the day, we were trading substantially lower than before the data came out, despite the really big drawdown on inventory. U.S. production is back up. Exports are not up. So where did that oil go? Well, to solve that mystery and others, let's go ahead now and meet this week's expert panel. Dr. Anas Alhaji is an author, keynote speaker, and energy markets expert. He was formerly the chief economist for NGP Energy Capital Management, and he also taught energy economics at University of Oklahoma and Colorado School of Mines. Anas, you have focused a lot of your research on the unintended consequences of energy policy and regulations. What do you see in the light of the 2020 elections and the various proposals that are on the table?
Eric, there are too many, and people can write books on this. But for the sake of saving time, I will focus only on biofuel and ethanol. The focus, of course, is on unintended consequences and policy contradictions at the same time. Take, for example, the push for electric vehicles and biofuel at the same time, especially by Democrats. Both are encouraged and subsidized by the government. More electric vehicles mean less demand for internal combustion engine cars. That's what we call ICE cars, which means less demand for gasoline, and we usually blend biofuel with gasoline. We blend ethanol with gasoline. So more electric vehicles means less demand for ethanol. Democrats want the vote of their base, but at the same time, they don't want to annoy U.S. farmers. They support ethanol and biofuel. But at the same time, they think EVs, that's electric vehicles, is the way to go to combat climate change or at least reduce emissions in big cities, which hurt farmers at the end. So how are they going to work out such contradiction? Will we see farmers lobby against EVs, for example, in D.C.? Republicans want the vote of farmers, so they support ethanol and biodiesel. But the oil industry by nature supports Republicans and does not like such policies. How are they going to manage such contradictions? The irony here is farmers benefit from ethanol. Urban populations benefit from electric vehicles. Most rural areas are Republicans, and most of the urban areas are Democrats. How will this play out in 2020 or even in the coming elections after 2020? Look at this issue worldwide. The size of the biofuel industry has reached about $200 billion supported by government subsidies for the sake of the environment. The unintended consequences that farmers and agribusinesses are clearing forests to make land available to plant crops for biofuel. So how this work that we are clearing the forest that we need to reduce emissions? Many Democrats support carbon tax to adjust for the externalities of fossil fuel. I personally support carbon tax if they impose carbon tax on biofuel and count for all the carbon that the cleared forest would have taken. To conclude, and this is my last statement on this segment, Eric, policy contradictions and unintended consequences are eliminating most or all of the good things that will come out of these policies in 2020 or after.
Thanks, Hannes. Our next panelist is Art Berman, a petroleum geologist who spends most of his time drilling oil wells, but he's also become a favorite keynote speaker and consultant to investors. Art put together a slide deck for today's show, and you can download it from our homepage at macrovoices.com. Just look for the download link in the description of today's podcast. Art, stock prices for E&P companies have fallen about 55% since early October of 2018 and down 37% since April of 2019. The standard narrative is that investors have gotten sick and tired of negative cash flow. Is that a reasonable explanation, or is there something more to the story here?
Well, Eric, I mean, like all narratives, there's some truth to it, or it would never gain any traction. But I've spent quite a bit of time over the last week or so examining this cash flow narrative. And my conclusion is that it seems sensible enough, except that the data absolutely doesn't fit it. And so just the principal points, the slides give you a lot of detail, is that many of these oil companies, tight oil companies with positive cash flow for 2018 and some for 2017 have had their stocks hammered. And some of the companies with negative cash flow have had relatively better stock performance than some of the others. So that's not exactly computing correctly. The more general comment I want to make, though, is that negative cash flow is a necessary component for oil companies to develop a discovery. So there's nothing intrinsically wrong about negative cash flow if growth is what you want. The problem for the shale plays is that they never get out of development mode because of the high decline rates. What I think is going on is that investors are increasingly disaffected by the oil companies, first of all, because they've lost trust. They've been told basically what they consider to be a big pack of lies about break-even costs and profits and et cetera. And they're just not getting returns from these companies. That's valid. But I think more importantly, they sense that there's really no hope for big profits until sometime when there's really a big supply crunch in the future. And so what I ended up doing here, which I think is interesting and sobering, is I went into a detailed analysis of what's called the standardized measure, which is just the discounted future cash flows of all the proved reserves that a company has. This is company data. And I use that to figure out, well, what exactly is the break-even price in the Permian Basin and some other places? And I think to some people's shock, it's about $60 a barrel. Now, what they've been telling the world is it's like $40 a barrel. Now, $60 a barrel doesn't surprise me, but I bring it up not to get into the weeds about the details of break-even price, but this is what information the companies are telling the Securities and Exchange Commission indicates, and I think it fits with investor dissatisfaction, that investors were very excited about oil when the price was low and they thought it could go much higher. They were excited about the idea that the U.S. can produce oil at lower prices than Saudi Arabia or some such nonsense. I think what's happening is that reality is setting in, and they're realizing that this tight oil is about the same cost as everything else and that the upside's just not there.
Thanks for your perspective on that, Art. I want to get the rest of the panel's perspective on this question of valuations in the oil equities. But first, let's meet our final panelist today. Tracy Schuchart is a professional crude oil trader who worked on the floor of the exchange in Chicago before moving on to become a full-time futures trader. Tracy, the macro backdrop behind the oil market seems to be getting more complex by the day. And of course, today was a doozy with both inventory and FOMC coming out on the same day. Please give us your latest thoughts on how the macro backdrop is developing, what's driving prices right now, and what you're watching as a trader.
Sure. First, we're seeing an uptick in oil prices, and everybody's been asking me, why are we seeing an uptick? So I quickly want to go over some of the reasons behind this. And we've already gone into length about the Iran situation. That situation, it's still tense, but pretty much calmed down. I don't think that oil is reacting to that necessarily right now. But here's what I do think it's reacting to. So Q2, we saw rather low demand in part due to lower power generation for heating and cooling. Q3, this summer, we've seen extreme weather in Europe as well. We have a seasonal boost of demand in the Middle East. That's supportive of oil prices. We had a rate cut just now. What surprised me is that it was kind of a hawkish cut. Going to trademark that. And we saw the market kind of tank on that, but oil still held up on that. So that kind of reinforces my sort of bullish to firm bias for the oil market right now. Permian bottlenecks are starting to ease. EPIC's already starting to fill new 400,000 barrel per day oil pipeline from Permian to the Gulf Coast. IMO is right around the corner, and the call on distillates will be 1.4 million barrels per day in 2020 from IMO. And as a result, the baseline scenario indicates that processing rates will increase by 890,000 barrels per day in 2020. So that's going to be a huge uptick in demand, and we're already starting to see that uptick happening. As we're going into, you know, we only have a 6-month lead time right now at this point. So we're starting to see demand from that. Refining margins are on fire right now, which is also supportive of crude prices. We have a strength in the front end of fuel oil cracks. This has provided a strong anchor right now as well. Obviously, any further deterioration of the global economy would put downward pressure on this curve. But so far, this curve is holding up. And then finally, a thing I want to touch upon is this earnings season has been pretty good for oil companies, surprisingly. And this gives investor confidence and I believe a renewed interest in oil. You have to remember, spec positioning has been depressed, open interest wise. So we still have lots of room for longs to jump on any sign of economic improvement or renewed interest.
Tracy, thanks so much for your perspective. As we move into our panel discussion, I want to bring everyone else in on this discussion of the macro backdrop because so many things are changing so quickly. And of course, we have the Fed and their rate cut today as well. Anas, why don't we start with you? What's your perspective on the macro and what Tracy said?
Well, generally speaking, as you know, today, the news basically is about the US dollar and the interest rate. But whenever we talk about the bullish factors versus the bearish factors, I would like to point out the following. Most micro variables are bullish. So when you talk about what Art is talking about, when you talk about company level, when you talk about field by field, well by well, etc., that's the micro. But when you talk about the macro variables, such as the dollar interest rate, government spending, taxes, etc., that's the macro. So if you look at the micro, the variables are bullish. We are talking about declining crude inventories, slowing growth in shale production, improving refinery utilization. Of course, today we lost the Baytown refinery. There was fire in it, so we don't know really what happened and whether that's short-term or long-term. But generally speaking, the trend is improving refinery utilization. So these are bullish factors. But if you look at the macro variables, they are bearish. You are talking about what Tracy mentioned, slowing global economic growth, weakening oil demand growth, and then the strengthening of the U.S. dollar, increasing taxes on fuel in the United States, as we've seen on the 1st of July, where I think 13 states increased gasoline taxes. And worldwide, we are seeing this trend too, especially in countries like India, where they increased taxes substantially on products. Just one more point I would like to mention here is when we talk about the relationship between oil prices and the dollar, these daily relationships that some people talk about, these are made up. These were born in 2009 during the financial crisis, and people believe they are real. There is no theoretical basis for those daily relationships. But if people and traders believe them, then they will happen. But there is an impact because higher dollar in the, not on daily basis, but on monthly and yearly basis or quarterly basis, higher dollar makes oil expensive in countries where the currencies are depreciating. And that reduces demand. Higher dollar is really kind of bearish for oil because in countries like Russia and areas like the North Sea, the cost of producing oil goes down because about 60% of the cost is paid in local currencies, which is declining. So if you look at the North Sea, for example, you look at Russia, they benefit from higher dollar because their cost is declining in their local currencies while they are selling the oil in U.S. dollar. So the macro variables basically are bearish, but the micro variables are bullish.
Art Berman, what's your perspective on the developing macro backdrop and what's your outlook for oil prices?
It's very interesting, everything that, Tracy and Anas are saying, Eric, and I have to agree, of course, but as I look at, what happened, let's say, just today with the inventory draw, I mean, we are substantially below where prices ought to be. I mean, we had a, we're only 13 million barrels above the five-year average. We basically dropped that in half in 1 week, and yet oil prices have really not moved. And sure, it's overshadowed by the Fed and et cetera, but the macro picture for me, when I combine that with what looks like considerable lack of interest in where oil markets go, the decreasing share of the S&P 500. I mean, we're down to 4.5% from 6%. I just think that the macro outlook is something is going to have to happen dramatically to cause oil prices to go up. I mean, if today's draw didn't cause oil prices to go up, no matter what's going on, the markets are pretty disinterested in oil right now. So, you know, the real issue, I think, is we've seen rally after rally that fails. Every time there's an oil price rally, producers start overproducing and the price goes down. And I think that the investment community, the financial community is just saying, okay, what if Bob Dudley's right? You know, what if we're looking at lower for longer? What if we're looking at $55 forever? Hard to get very excited about putting money in the oil business. So, I mean, to me, it's the macro picture for oil is, from a price perspective, is depressing looking at it from the macro viewpoint. Looking at the details, as Honest and I do, there's all kinds of reasons to get pretty, you know, pretty excited or pretty worried about where prices may go. So, I guess I'm saying that's a big agree with Anas's comments. But what I'm really saying is, yes, Tracy's comment about all the open interest, there's lots of room for things to go up. I just think something very dramatic has to happen to get people interested enough to push them up.
Tracy Shuchart, let's come back to you, both reactions to Anas and Art, and what else can you tell us about your perspective on the developing price situation?
First, I want to clarify my position. I'm not an oil bull. Pretty much everybody knows that. But I do think that there's reasons why we're seeing a firmer Q3 market. Why, you know, when we were at 50, when we were just down at 55, everybody was like, it's going to tank, et cetera. But here we go. You know, we keep getting, every time we get to this 55, 56 area, it keeps getting bid up again. So I'm not a super bull. I don't think that, you know, oil is going, you know, over 65 anytime soon. But I do think that for Q3, for all the reasons that I have laid out, that we are going to see firmer oil prices. Now, in the fall, when we start to have that demand pull off, then that's another story. Then I expect much weaker oil prices. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Tracy, here are two points basically that are kind of really important to mention. The first one is all we have here is we have the bullish factors on the macro level. We have the bearish factors on the macro level, and they are fighting with each other. And whatever the net, that's when we heard Art talking about the failed rallies, and Tracy said the same thing too. I think we should pay a close attention to the fact that Brent is not in the 40s. And I think we should look at the other half of the glass, that if you look at all the macro variables alone, without the push from the micro, Brent should be in the 40s, and it's not. So in a sense, regardless of being bullish or bearish on oil right now, the fact is we have $20 above the bottom line in Brent, and that's good. That showed that the oil market's still healthy, despite the fact that investors are not interested.
I want to move on to a topic that has me perplexed, and I suspect some of you. Normally, inventory works kind of like a balance sheet. You've got the input sides, which is how much production occurred in the United States, as well as how much oil was imported. And then you've got the output sides, which is how much was consumed by refineries and how much was exported. It's all kind of supposed to balance out. We've got an 8.5 million barrel drawdown on inventory in a week where we did not see an increase in exports. It's 2.6 million barrels a day. That's smaller than what we've seen over the last several weeks. So it's not about that. Meanwhile, U.S. production is back up to 12.2 million barrels where it's supposed to be. It's not a question of U.S. production going down. Where did the oil go? The 8.5 million barrels that was drawn down this week, is it possible that the data reporting itself is wrong? Or did somehow refineries refine a whole bunch of product that didn't go into finished product inventories? Because they're drawn down massively too. Where is the oil going? Anas Al-Haji, let's start with you.
Okay. Eric, as you know, in the past, we dedicated a large part of the show to talk about data quality and how bad the data is. And today's number basically includes some of the outages in the Gulf of Mexico because not all the production basically is back. So it does that, but the number is really large. And if you look at the fact that the storage report came out at the same time that the 914 report came out, which is the monthly report for May, they came out at the same time, and both of them were really bad reports in terms of data quality. We usually don't have that. We usually have the weekly data that is really bad. But the monthly report this time is as confusing as the weekly report. And that raises so many questions. To give you an idea, and as you know on this show, Art and I raised this issue so many times on the adjustment. And I claim until today that this adjustment has nothing to do with the plant condensate. You cannot go from a very small number, like 50, 60,000 barrels a day in 1 week, to a million barrels a day the second week, and I'm talking about the change, and claim it is plant condensate. It's something else. So this time, the change in adjustment is almost a million barrel. In May, if you look at the monthly report, the change is 18 million barrels. This is just, I mean, the plant condensate cannot make it. So The best thing I can say is, since both came in the same week, in the same day, it's probably there is something wrong with the data. Probably someone is on vacation and someone is replacing them.
Art Berman, you watch this very closely because of all of your work on comparative inventory data. Both this week's number as well as the May 914 report, the monthly data for the month of May. What do you make of this? Where did that 8.5 million barrels of oil that was drawn out of storage go?
I think we're in a case of thin air. You know, we're back into modern monetary theory or something here. I'm very glad to hear Anas voices his view on data quality, because honestly, that has to be the only explanation that we're seeing an overcompensation in this week's report for some previous week's reports where there were good reasons for inventory to fall, and yet it didn't. But you mentioned the issue of unaccounted for oil, or someone did, Eric or Anas, and this is something I follow. And what I note this week, and some people think unaccounted for oil is a bogus fudge factor. I don't, but you know, whatever. It doesn't have necessarily the same credibility. But what I will say is we had a pretty big draw 2 weeks ago, and we had a big draw this week. And both times, the unaccounted for oil volume reversed. In other words, we've seen almost consistent increased unaccounted for oil by 3, 4, 5 million barrels every week, crude oil. And this week it was minus 3.6. So if you just do the arithmetic on the field production, the net imports, the refinery intakes, we should have had a good draw of about 4.9 million barrels. But if you add in the 3.6 almost of unaccounted for oil, that's where you get to 8.5. So whatever you think about unaccounted for oil, whether it's a fudge factor that's somehow accumulating errors, or whether you actually think that it's, you know, it's real as I do, it's just that it doesn't quite fit with the weekly information, that's a change. So I pay attention to that. But beyond that, they're really, I mean, you look at consumption, you look at refinery intakes, imports, exports of both crude and product, and it's just very, very difficult to see how we cut our comparative inventory in half in a single week.
Tracy Shuchart, you're the trader on this week's panel. Does it make sense that perhaps the muted tape reaction, the price didn't move up so much on this big number? Is it maybe because the market sees through this and questions whether it's a real number?
No, I don't think so at all. You know, I mean, the fact that we didn't tank on a big draw is actually pretty amazing to me. Usually when we have a huge draw, you have, you know, the opposite reaction. It comes down. But aside from the trading part of it, first, I think that the last 3 weeks because of the storm, you know, I think there's been data issues. As far as the unaccounted for oil, I have to go in defense of EIA. I don't know if anybody follows Mason Hamilton, but he put out, I don't know, a 30 tweet thread on exactly how the unaccounted oil for is done. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they have a 1 to 2% error ratio. And because we're producing so much more oil now, that 1 to 2% margin of error that they are allowed is now a lot bigger, because now it's 1 to 2% of 12 million barrels, not 6 million barrels. So I just have to say, if you're interested, is Mason Hamilton on Twitter, go look at his thread and where he explains how exactly they do the unaccounted for oil.
Yeah, but Tracy, there is a response to that. The response is, why all of a sudden we have an explosion of the adjustment just in November 2018 and after? If this is just a constant percentage and the production being increasing almost linearly, then it should be consistent with that line. But we have everything normal, and all of a sudden we have an explosion in November 2018. So from November until now, that's where the problem is, and that's cannot explain by that percentage.
And I have to say, too, that I can't follow Mason's comments because he blocked me, and he blocked me because he doesn't like me talking about unaccounted for oil. And I'm with you, Tracy. I am a defender of EIA, and I don't think that anything I've said about unaccounted for oil implies that they're not doing a good job, although Honest's comments do need to be somehow integrated into this. I think it just takes us back to the fact that there is, this week certainly, every week for a long while, albeit, you know, notwithstanding unaccounted for oil, there seems to be some salient feature that more or less explains what happened. I think this week I just have to throw my hands up and say, let's wait until next week and, you know, and see if things balance out a little bit, because there simply is no obvious solution that I'm seeing in the data.
And I agree with that, absolutely, with you, Art, because I think that, you know, just the last 3 weeks, because of the storm, because of the closures and things like that, that the data is kind of out of whack. And I think we need another week to see really what it is.
I want to come back to Art Berman's slide deck. Art, you've got quite a bit here on something that we've gotten quite a few listener emails about, which is what's really going on for people who invest in the oil market through oil-related stocks. What is the story here? Art, could you walk us through your slide deck, and then I want to get reactions from the panelists.
Yeah, sure, Eric. So if we start on slide 3, this is essentially the the narrative that I went over very, very quickly in my introductory comments. And what I've done here is I just wanted to examine this cash flow narrative. And to repeat, the narrative that's out there is that investors are tired of negative cash flow, and that's the reason that they're abandoning particularly tight oil, but oil company stocks more generally. And I've got a, I guess it's, I don't want to call it a bias, but it is a perspective on narratives. And that is that these narratives, they seem sensible. If enough people repeat them, smart people start to believe them, but often the data doesn't support them. And I use as an example, the supposed OPEC price war versus shale. I mean, I think that's a great example. Everybody, or almost everybody, now accepts that as truth. But I don't. I mean, I don't find any evidence whatsoever that there's this, there was or is some conscious effort by Saudi Arabia or OPEC to bankrupt U.S. shale companies. I'm sure they wish they would go away, but I just don't see that. And yet people accept that. So the cash flow narrative to me is sort of like that. And the reason that I sort of object to it is that I follow these things, and negative cash flow has been a reality in the E&P business long before there were tight oil companies. So if you look at my slide number 4, this is something I borrowed from Raymond James and some others. I mean, this shows that since 2001, there have only been 3 years where the industry overall approached cash flow neutrality. 1 year where we were cash flow positive, that was 2005, slightly just a little bit north of neutral in 2004, 2003, and 2016. And all the rest of those years, the industry was spending more than it made. So this is the norm for, you know, whatever the reasons are, and I don't want to get into it. This is the way the oil business always is. So for investors to somehow decide in the last 6 or 12 months, oh, we're tired of negative cash flow, it just doesn't work. The slide that follows, number 5, Eric, you've actually quoted most of what's contained in here, but it just emphasizes, this is actually USO, which is an index of oil company stocks, and it's normalized, so it's easy to look at here. And what it shows is that the value of oil company stocks has fallen 55% just since October of 2018, and almost 40% just since April of 2019. So is this really because all of a sudden one day investors woke up and said, oh, we're tired of negative cash flow? Slide 6 simply shows what Tracy's already mentioned, which is the tremendous decline in open interest. So the red curve is combined Brent, WTI open interest. Again, it's normalized and scaled. So you can see, I mean, it's a very dramatic reduction. Getting on to 7, though, what I'm looking at here, the left-hand graph, I'm looking at a group of companies that are generally kind of more diverse companies. They're not pure players and one shale play or another. Some of them like Marathon and Apache and Oxy, or they have quite diverse portfolios of even international. I think EOG even has some international holdings. And so I'm looking here at the CapEx to cash flow, cash from operation ratio. And most of these companies have had positive cash flow or cash neutral for the last 2 years. And yet looking at the graph on the right, which is sort of busy, what I've done here is I simply normalized all of these companies' stock price and normalized WTI. And what you can see in this case is that certainly since the fourth quarter of last year, all of these companies, some of whom have positive cash flow for a couple of years and none of whom are particularly egregious, their stocks have all been hammered. So the argument just doesn't wash in this case. Slide number 8, here we're looking at Permian companies, all right? And these are pure Permian players, companies that have no other holdings that I'm aware of outside the Permian Basin, Parsley, Diamondback, Laredo, Pioneer, and Concho. And all of these companies have pretty negative cash flow. Concho and Pioneer were close to neutral in 2018, but you know, and this shouldn't surprise anyone. And then we look at the graph on the right, which is the same normalized stock price versus WTI. And what we find is that these companies, they're kind of all over the place. But Diamondback, which has very negative cash flow for the last 4 years, it's in pink on the right. It's the company whose stock price is doing absolutely the best. So are we really tired of negative cash flow in the Permian? And I won't go into the details of all of these, but number nine is Eagle Ford, same kind of analysis. Murphy had the most negative cash flow, but its stock price didn't suffer. Next slide, number 10, is Bakken. You know, here's a funny situation. I mean, so Hess has had terrible cash flow for the last 4 years, and yet of all these Bakken-weighted companies, its stock price is pretty much tracking WTI. So, you know, there's the argument. The argument is people say that, but when you actually try to calibrate it to data, it's very hard to say that that's what's going on. So this final slide that I want to show is slide 11. To me, this is really important, and I'm going to take just a second to explain it. So in the annual reports that companies file with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the 10-K, they are required to present something called the standardized measure. So the standardized measure of oil and gas is abbreviated here as SMOG. I didn't invent that. I just use it because it fits the columns better than the whole word. And so what that is they take all of their discounted future cash flows from their proved reserves and they put a value on it. So they say after production costs, given that this year's SEC oil price or BOE price, this is the value of all of those reserves. And so what I did here is I said, okay, let's just take the SMOG for the proved undeveloped portion, and let's take the number of reserves, the PUD, the proved undeveloped reserves, and divide the two. And that should tell you on a barrel of oil equivalent basis, how much value above $65.56, which is the SEC price, each one of those companies is making. Okay. And that's shown in the fourth column. And so then I have a break-even SMOG, which is simply that value minus the SEC price. And then because this standardized measure doesn't include things like general and administrative, it doesn't include interest expense, it doesn't include some other costs, I've taken those numbers straight from the same company data, variable OPEX, operating expenses, added it back in, and we get a break-even price or an implied break-even price. And what it shows then in the last two columns is that for the Permian pure players, the weighted average of all those companies is almost $60, and the range is pretty tight. You know, it's 58 to 65 in the case of Laredo. And then we look at the CapEx to cash flow from operations column, and it's pretty high. It's 1.5. And then I look in the second table of companies that have, most of them have tight oil holdings. I've included ExxonMobil in there just to give some calibration on the world. But these are diversified companies, and you do the same exercise there, and lo and behold, their break-even prices are actually lower than the pure Permian players. And look at their CapEx to cash flow. It's a third or nearly a third on the weighted average basis of the Permian pure players. So what you would conclude from this is that if people are really tired of negative cash flow, then we should see EOG and Exxon and Oxy and Continental stock prices soaring. And yet that's absolutely not what's going on. So my conclusion then is that I think that that we're tired of negative cash flow obviously is a bogus narrative. It does encompass a reality, which is that investors have lost interest and they're abandoning these stocks. And there are lots of reasons for that. But it's just not as simple as the common narrative wants to make it. So I'll leave it there and see if anybody else on the panel wants to comment.
Anas Alhaji, let's get your perspective. How does art's analysis jibe with your perspective on the market?
Eric, here is what I like about art. Art basically is a well-known expert, but he behaves like a true academic where we all keep learning until the last moment of our lives. And that's what I really like about art, because if you look at all his research in the last few years and you see the development and what he is talking about now, you can see that. And I'm saying this as a great compliment to art by discounting the cash flow argument. But here is kind of a something to complement what he said. I seriously think that what happened in the last 8 to 9 months to the stocks of those companies, especially in the Permian, is a reflection of crude quality matters. It's a reflection of the fact that what they are producing is gasier. So gas is sold at a negative price or flared. So that's a negative. NGLs lost 50% of their value. That's a negative. Whatever percentage left of black oil is really little, probably 30 to 40%, and oil prices are low. So while it is not about cash flow, it could be a reflection of crude quality that we've been talking about for a long time. Investors are looking at it and they see worse. In a sense, they see no end in sight. The situation is getting worse every day. And in fact, the crude quality is hitting the industry on all levels, not only in terms of refining and marketing and products in the future that we need. It's hitting the industry in a sense that all those fires and all those problems that we are facing right now and all the interruptions and unplanned outages probably is related to the fact that we have serious problems with the new mix, with the crude quality. We have lack of heavy crude, a lot of light and super light crude and condensates, and probably causing so many problems around the U.S. So another explanation to the, if cash flow is not the issue here, another explanation could be crude quality.
Tracy Shuchart, how does Art's analysis jibe with your perspective on the market?
Well, I'm kind of going to come at this from a little bit different angle, because I'm actually not as negative as these guys are right now on crude stocks. I think they've been really beaten up, and I think so. There's kind of an opportunity here, to be honest. Earnings have been pretty good so far this year, which again, I think will help support oil prices, keep them a little bit firm. This year seems to be, for these oil companies, seems to be cash is king. Investors want to see positive cash flow, as Art mentioned, conservative spending, dividends, stock buybacks. And this year, Q2 is kind of delivering those kind of results. And, you know, we've seen oil, you know, up the last, you know, couple weeks during this earnings season since they started reporting. 2 years ago, everyone in the Permian wanted to target the highest possible production by 2025. Investors didn't want to hear this because they just weren't performing cash-wise. And Pioneer just this year on their conference call said that investors told them, hey, we're going to dump this stock if you keep adding rigs. So I think these companies are hearing what investors want. And I think they're pulling back on adding these rigs and having these high production numbers and focusing more on, you know, internals. I mean, all these companies were overextended in debt, which again, just like Art said, it's not in and of itself, it's not that terrible, but, you know, investors didn't want to see this anymore. Like, companies have tried to cut expenditures by laying off people, which is not the best. Cutting down on rigs, mergers, they're selling out to larger companies, and their bottom line is, you know, showing that this is working. So I'm a little bit more upbeat really right now on some of these oil companies. I think there's some opportunity there. On an interesting side note, we're actually starting to see some improvement in the offshore arena, which has been pretty beat up as well, very beat up since 2017. There's quite a lot of new projects this year. We're starting to see a uptick in the number of rigs and rig supply and demand. Finally, small uptick, but still it's positive news after 3 years. And we're seeing some of these moves off the lows. Also, aggregate offshore spending is also ticking up from the 2017 lows. Not a ton, but it's well worth keeping your eye on, in my opinion. So I'm just kind of coming back at it as from an investor point of view.
And I appreciate that, Tracy. And I want to expand a little bit on what you just said and explain why underneath this negativity, there is sort of a kind of silver lining for future opportunity, as you suggest. So I haven't shown it because I think what I showed today is already a lot. Maybe I'll show it the next time I'm on this panel, which I think is next week. But if you look at the proportion, let's take Pioneer as an example, since you mentioned, you know, their shareholders are going for the doors if they put on any more rigs. If you look at the proved undeveloped reserves of a company like Pioneer, it's a pitiful small number compared with their proved producing reserves. It's something like 13 or 14%. And so where are they going to go with that? And somebody can say, oh, well, they'll always find more reserves. But the truth is there's not a lot of dry powder there, if you want to use the cliche. They're pretty near the end of the easy stuff to exploit. So that says that Permian production, at least for Pioneer, cannot continue to increase because they simply don't have the reserves. So that should lead to a more bullish view, at least for the medium term, if not sooner. But the problem that I see in all of this is that these companies cannot deliver positive cash flow, most of them. And the reason for that is what I showed in the tables, that if they need $60 to break even and oil prices are below $60, how in the world are they going to show positive cash flow if oil prices stay where they are? And I think the reason that the more diversified companies have more positive cash flow and have a lower break-even price goes back to Anas's comment that they are not tethered to this poor quality oil. And because they're more diversified, when things are not going so well in the Permian, well, they can benefit from what's going on in the North Sea, or they can up their production in the deep water Gulf of Mexico. And finally, Tracy, I think you bring up a really important point, and that is that if you look at the proved reserves of the world right now, whatever you think about shale, we are going to live on deep water reserves until we have a supply crunch sometime in the 2020s. I mean, that's where the big fields are. So it's important that things start looking better in the offshore, because that's what we're going to survive on for the next 5 or 10 years.
Let's talk about what that costs, Art. How does the cost as we go back, let's say at some point, as you say, we have to get back into the production of a lot of offshore, deep water offshore oil in order to make up for, I think, what eventually has to be a decline in U.S. shale production. How much more does it cost to do that than to continue to produce shale at today's costs?
Well, that's a great question. And to be honest with you, I haven't, other than looking at a couple of the big companies like Exxon, they don't break out their reserves. Since they're not a pure player, it's really difficult to understand. But what I do hear from the experts and from the commentators, the analysts that I trust, is that the costs are coming down substantially in the offshore as well. And my guess, and that's all it is right now, I would be surprised if the discounted future cash flow of the offshore is very much more, if at all, higher than $60. Now, maybe I'm off base here, and Tracy or Anas can tell me if they think I am, but I look at ExxonMobil, who has holdings in every kind of play in the world, and they're showing, you know, a pretty respectable break-even price, even with, and I got to say this, I mean, their general and administrative costs are horrifying. I mean, it costs them something like $8 per BOE just to keep the lights on. And, you know, that doesn't really surprise me, but that's a staggering number. And they're still showing a break-even price, which is better than pure Permian players. So I want to believe that the offshore makes sense at $60 a barrel. Listen to Bob Dudley's comments just the other day. You know, he's not the only expert on it, but BP certainly was a pioneer, a leader in the deepwater Gulf of Mexico. And he's saying we're okay at $55. I want to believe him.
I'll just throw in my own perspective on this, and it is speculative. I don't have any hard data to back it. I think the right model for investors to think about is this comes in waves. If you go back to how the shale revolution happened, in the beginning, shale production was extremely expensive. Break-even prices were north of $80 a barrel when we only had a few, you know, few operators that even had horizontal drilling rigs. And what happens is, as the technology becomes more pervasive, the price comes down and you invent efficiencies like pad drilling made a big difference. And my expectation is that when shale plays out, oil prices go up quite a bit as we have to go to offshore and deep water offshore. And there's not a whole lot of those offshore rigs that are you know, and the vessels that do that kind of work. There's a shortage of those. The prices are high. The break-evens are high. And then you build more boats. You use robotics to automate the systems, and it gets better. I don't know exactly what the innovations are, but it'll get better. The break-even costs will come down. And so I expect there is a wave of higher prices, but I think it probably comes back down as the technology that's needed in order to deliver that next kind of production, which I agree with you is deep water offshore, kind of comes into focus. Anas, what's your perspective on what Art and I just said?
Well, I just want to make a distinction that, as everyone knows, basically, the projects in offshore are 25 to 30 years. So when companies basically commission those projects, they look at the average price throughout this period. While in shale, we have only 2 to 3 years, and that's it. So there is a big difference here. And the issue to me right now here is, what does the majors or the oil majors entry into shale means when you have projects that will last for 25 years or 30 years versus projects that will last only 3 years. While one of them is very light, super light, and gasier, and gas prices are negative, while the other one basically is mostly everything is really valuable. And this, I think this issue need to be studied in more details, because I think the majors are making a big mistake by going in full force into shale at the expense of offshore.
Well, that really raises a question in my mind, just thinking about macro risks, is from what you've said, Anas, if you're only going to amortize the capital expenditure of a shale well over 3 years, then even at a certain break-even price, you know, it's not that much money. If what you're talking about is a 25 or 30-year project, that's a whole lot of CapEx up front in order to get that thing working. And what that says to me is, if we had another macro disruption where there's, say, a credit market disruption, and suddenly the credit is no longer available because we have another 2008 or something, and there's a credit crisis, if the CapEx that is going to be required for offshore is that much bigger, it says to me the risk is more in the availability of credit than there is anything that specifically has to do with oil fields and oil operations. Would you agree with that?
Well, the only difference is oil companies basically are sitting on a lot of, the majors are sitting on a lot of cash. So the credit is not going to affect them as much as the shale companies.
But as you've said, by going into shale production, they're spending a lot of that cash that they might need in order to bring those big 25 or 30-year projects online when the time comes to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You are right.
Tracy Shuchart, you sent us a couple of charts in a separate chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link in addition to Art's chart deck. Tracy, give us some perspective on what those two charts are telling us about this discussion.
This is just on offshore. Basically, it's international offshore aggregate spending. So it's just a layout of kind of where 2017 was the lowest in the, you know, last 10, 15 years, and that we're kind of ticking up. This means that companies are once again interested in exploring offshore and willing to put money forth. And then the second one is just the offshore project tracking list. And this shows what projects have been awarded this year and what is looking to be awarded next year. And there's a lot more projects over this year and next year than there have been in quite a number of years. So it looks like there's some excitement in the offshore industry.
Tracy, as you know, after 2010 and what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, we had a decline in offshore. But any information on the concentration of those projects, whether they are concentrated or they are not?
As far as location?
Yes.
Location-wise, there's South America, Asia Pacific, and Middle East is basically where it's broken down the most.
Anas Alhaji, you have the last point before we have to call it a wrap for this week.
Well, generally speaking, regarding what Art explained about the company's valuation and stocks and what Tracy alluded to, it seems it is mostly probably about access, whether they have easy access to markets and pipelines and refineries, and it is about crude quality and what included in that. That might explain Hess, for example, relative to the others in terms of access to, and then what the percentage of natural gas in that, and that's where the Permian versus Bakken and Oklahoma and other places. So it's probably there are more arguments than just the cash flow, as Art mentioned.
Thanks, Anas. Listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town and that we intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in energy markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com, and you'll also gain access to our Thursday night podcast, which has a much more general macroeconomic focus. We're also looking for sponsors so that we can keep all of our Macro Voices content free to the listener. To save time here on the podcast, I've prepared a detailed video explaining the opportunity for sponsoring Macro Voices Energy Week. You can find the video at macrovoices.com/sponsor info. If your company is interested in sponsoring Macro Voices Energy Week or any of our other content, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I want to ask each of our panelists what they're going to be watching for in energy markets in the week ahead. Art Berman, what will you be looking for in the week ahead?
I am desperately interested to see what information is out there that helps me somehow, helps all of us resolve this kind of confusing inventory report that we had this week. I think we've gone over that, but I'm still confused and I need to understand. So that will be my primary focus, at least in the coming days.
Thanks, Art. Anas Alhaji, what will you be looking for in the week ahead?
Well, I'm looking at how the higher dollar and the lower interest rate is going to play in the market and its impact on the oil market and the oil companies. And of course, we are looking at the quarterly reports from various oil companies too.
And Tracy Shuchart, what will you be watching for in the week ahead?
Absolutely. I have to agree. Same thing. We're looking at the weekly petroleum reports. And I also am interested in to see what earnings are all about.
Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. Next week's panel includes Art Berman, Pat Hemsworth, and Chris Cook. But before we let this week's panel go, I'd like to ask each of you to please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Anas Alhaji, let's start with you.
Twitter, Anas Alhaji, AnasAlhaji, where I post most of my concluding thoughts. And my website is the same, anasalhaji.com.
Thanks, Anas. ArtBerman.com. What can we find there?
ArtBerman.com will have hopefully a more detailed summary of the work that I've presented on standardized measure and break-even prices. Like Anas, Tracy, I'm always on Twitter at AEBerman12. If you want to get more into direct contact, it's businessmanager@artberman.com.
Tracy Shuchart, call sign Shy Girl. That's where we can find you on Twitter. What can we expect to find there?
So Shy Girl, at Shy Girl, obviously is my Twitter handle. At shygirl.com is my website. And I post all sorts of information with regards to not only just oil, but macro view and equities too.
And that spelling is Chigrl, like Chicago Girl. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. See you next week, everybody.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.